Bless Master, the Master-Disciple Approach to Education, was a talk given by Matt Bianco at the 2025 Gutenberg Education Conference titled Teacher as Mentor. Dr. Matthew Bianco is the Chief Operation Officer for the CIRCE Institute, where he also serves as a head mentor in the CIRCE Apprenticeship Program. He and his wife homeschooled their three children, all of whom have graduated from amazing schools like St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, and the Honors College at Belmont Abbey in Charlotte, North Carolina. He is married to his altogether lovely high school sweetheart, Patricia. Dr. Matt Bianco has a PhD in Humanities from Faulkner University's Great Books Honors College. He is the author of Letters to My Sons, A Humane Vision for Human Relationships. We hope you enjoy this presentation.
Good morning again. When do I go till? I have till 10:15. Is that right, or around, thereabouts? Should I stop at 10:10 because I'm starting 5 minutes early?
Yeah.
Okay. I said earlier that I got to wear this Madonna mic, and the person I whispered it to said, "You're dating yourself." Yes, I am. I don't even know what it would be today. A Britney Spears mic? No, that's probably too old. Taylor Swift mic? Yeah. Well, I'm a pretty good dancer. That is not true at all. So, I was inspired yesterday by Chris's talk, where he started out describing his love for math and science and engineering type stuff, and then warning us all that he was going to give a talk that was in that vein, though his talk was actually defending the primacy of the right brain, right? Which was beautiful to see and behold. So I decided to start you off by also warning you something about myself. I pretend that I'm a comedian, and I try to make my talks as funny as possible. Two things as a result. One, I may not come across like I think the topic is very serious, but I do. So for those of you who are hoping I would be more serious about the topic, I am, but I bury it. Second, it's really, really painful if I make a joke and nobody laughs. It hurts so bad. Okay, good. Good start. Thank you. I appreciate that. Good start. You guys, you're warmed up, ready to go. It doesn't have to be funny either, but you still have to laugh, okay? When I do talks like this, afterwards people will ask me, how'd your talk go? And I always say, no matter, it's been saying this for years, I always say, they laughed when I wanted them to and they didn't when I didn't. So that's even how I judge my own success. Okay, so FYI, Chris is now my favorite student. I do have favorites. I will not hide that. It kind of was at the wrong time, actually. But I appreciated the gesture. You know, she gets it. All right, let's talk about the master and disciple approach to education. Probably a lot of this will actually ring loud and clear, like very true to all of the classical conversation folks in the room because of the setup there where the tutor teaches all of the, guides the students through all of this stuff. They don't, even an 11th grade tutor is, or challenge 3 tutor is tutoring math and science and Latin and literature and history and philosophy, theology, whatever it is. They're doing all of that stuff. And it's interesting because some of you may know this, but I worked for Classical Conversations for about 6 years as the academic director before I moved to CIRCE in 2015, about 10 years ago. And one of the complaints I would often hear from people leaving CC was that their children needed specialists to teach them. And I get it. And I'm not really arguing against that. But I think what I really want us to understand or see, what I hope we can see, is that when we do that, for the good that we're, whatever good we're trying to get from that change, we're giving up a different good. And we just, if we're aware of that and we still think it's worth it, fine. God be with you. I'm not going with you. No, I'm just kidding. but But yeah, may the Lord bless it. I think it's important that we know what's happening when we do that. So as you all know, I think it's already been said at some point during the weekend, at least I've heard it, is Christ's words from Luke that the disciple will become like his master. And that's both a good thing and a terrifying thing. I know myself, and it kind of scares me that people might be becoming like me. I mean, except if they become funny, that's good. But the weird thing is, though, when I read those words, I believe them because Jesus said them. I don't believe them based on experience. Like, it doesn't really feel to me like I see a bunch of kids growing up to be just like their teachers, except homeschoolers, maybe. Even Heidi mentioned yesterday in her talk that that Athena has a conversation with Telemachus, disguised Athena has a conversation with Telemachus, and she says that, you know, you're going to go on this journey and you're going to succeed because whose son you are. But then she says kind of the norm is like most sons don't become as good as their fathers. Most sons, and rarely do they ever exceed their fathers. But isn't the father a kind of mentor in a master discipleship relationship there? I don't know. It's just interesting, like, or maybe it does, and I just don't see it. Maybe disciples do always become like their masters, and I don't see it. Or maybe I don't want to believe it because I've had so many teachers that I didn't want to be like. And so I'm just hoping and praying to God, please don't let it be true for me, you know? And yet, I can remember in seventh grade, I had a math teacher who adored me. You can all guess why, right? And she took a strong affinity for me and began trying to encourage me in math. I loved math. It came easy to me. I enjoyed it. And I was going to study math, and she was convincing me to, like, go down the path toward becoming an engineer. And she was very encouraging, very kind, and very loving to me toward it. And I did. I was like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be an engineer. And the first thing I'm going to do is build a bridge across the Gulf of Mexico. Probably the world is glad I did not become an engineer. Then in eighth grade, I didn't have her as a teacher anymore, even though our seventh grade teachers typically moved up with us to eighth grade. She didn't. We had a new teacher, Mrs. Cherry. She was a good teacher, but she didn't like me as much. Why was that funny? And in eighth grade, I had this teacher, Mr. Phones, Sir Raymond Phones with an F. He was not a nice guy, didn't really like anybody, but every Friday at the end of class, he would set aside the last 15 minutes of class, and he would read a book out loud to us. He would move in front of his desk, because he had the chalkboard, his desk, and then he would pull out this big, tall, four-legged stool, and he would sit on it, and all of us are sitting here, and he would read this book to us. I don't remember which books he read to us except for one. He read Dracula to us. And I went back and reread that book later, like, man, it's fine. But his reading aloud to me made me want to be a word guy, a words guy, a wise guy. It made me want to love literature. And I had been a big, avid reader when I was young. Then middle school, I kind of stopped, right? But then he, like, kind of revived that for me. And so maybe that's an example in my own life of where two teachers influenced me to become like them. One of them, it was short-lived, but the other one, it lasted. It's kind of funny because almost everybody thinks of me today as a literature language guy and not a numbers guy. But when I had to take the GRE like 10 years ago, I still scored higher on the math section than the verbal section. After all these years of ignoring math, I still was better at it. Maybe I'm not following my nature and violating what God has called me to. Oh my God, I am. Bye, guys. I want to look now at kind of the history of all of this and see like what it's looked like in history. Because if you think back to the ancient world insofar as we know it, or what we know about it, what school did Plato go to? Like Athens Elementary? Athens Middle School? Athens High School? Nope. He followed a master. He followed Socrates around and wrote down what he was learning from him or whatever he did. Wrote down what Socrates was saying, even though in one of the conversations, Socrates said, don't write things down. Plato was like, what was that again? Let me get that down. Plato is discipled by a master. He's not alone. There are others with him, but there's this group of men following Socrates around, trying to become like him. Now, okay, we can point to that and say, yeah, but Socrates actually was a master of everything, and so it's easier to enter into that relationship. But, of course, as tradition says, who did Plato teach? Aristotle, right? And Aristotle was a member of the academy and was taught by Plato. Aristotle, again, went to a master and sought that master's wisdom, absorbed it, and then when it was time, when it was appropriate for him to do so, he challenged it and he modified it and he adapted it and he made it his own. And then he goes on to start a master discipleship program that we know of as the Lyceum. And as tradition says, his greatest student was Alexander the Great, which I've been told there's actually very little historical evidence for that, which kind of is weird to me. But anyways, there's like a tradition that says it, and we all really, really believe it. And then there's like the historian saying, well, probably not. I don't know. But the analogy still stands, right? The idea still stands that Alexander apparently had a master discipleship relationship with Aristotle. And even if he didn't, the fact that people say that and everybody believes it indicates that that was the norm then. As you kind of move forward into the medieval world, you see the same thing with all of the great artists, all of the great thinkers, like the guys at Chartres, whatever French word. At the school there, at the Sorbonne, all of these guys are discipling under masters. Michelangelo discipled under masters. He had a couple different masters along the way that whose names didn't stand out enough for me to think it was worth writing down. But probably there are some people who know who those men are. Michelangelo was discipled and had a patron that funded his work until he died, and then Michelangelo had to go move back in with his mom and dad. Still happening. the model is normative through the Middle Ages, at least through around the 11th century is when you can start seeing changes to it. But the model is also in the Bible, right? Jesus is a mentor to his disciples. As Chris pointed out yesterday, God was mentoring in a personal relationship his people and the leaders of his people before even the incarnation. The So you have this model kind of working all the way through Scripture, from the ancient parts of the Bible through the Gospels, and then that continues with Paul, and then with the Holy Spirit with all of us. You see that discipleship relationship, that master-disciple relationship. Jesus calls his disciples, they follow him, and he teaches them, he disciples them, he trains them, and they become like him in very real and palpable and obvious ways, right? They can perform miracles. They can cast out demons. They can heal. They can teach. They can speak with great wisdom and change people's lives and even whole civilizations, whole cities, states, and stuff like that. They have become like him. They have increased in their own personal holiness and their own personal relationship with God, much like he has with his Father, though slightly less perfected, right? Slightly imperfect, still capable of error. And yet, also, they know how to respond to those errors. Right? They know immediately. Like, this is the beautiful thing about Peter's story, right? Peter's always just reacting and making foolish declarations or doing foolish things, and then almost immediately repenting. It's beautiful to see how quickly he is able to do that. In history, the shift from the master discipleship approach to something more like I can only learn from specialists actually begins, as I understand it, at Oxford University, at the colleges at Oxford, which is sad because I think of Oxford as like the one everybody wants to be like they named a city in Mississippi after it because they were aspirational, I assume. What does that say about Paris, Ohio? I don't know. But it was at Oxford, I think, where they first started breaking the schools and the programs up into specialties, and you started going to a particular master for a particular training in a particular field. And so, at Chartres, there's a guy at Chartres who has mastered all seven liberal arts around this time, a little bit later, actually. He's mastered all the, somewhat later, and he's mastered all of the liberal arts, and people are afraid of him because they can't understand how it's possible for one guy to be such a competent master of all of the liberal arts. And then, a couple centuries later, that's already infected our way of thinking. Like, how can you be good at everything? Especially when you're talking about the liberal arts. How can you be a master of astronomy and music and geometry and arithmetic and be a wordsmith beyond comparison, right? So, somewhere around the 11th century, Oxford starts doing that, and it changes the nature of things for the relationships. Like, if I'm a student there and I am committing myself to just this one discipline, right, I'm cutting off access to more of what I'm capable of knowing under I think the false belief that it's not possible to be a master, which is why this guy that comes later is so scary. The Oxford didn't do it in a completely horrible way, though. Like, they maintained, like, each student had this tutor that was kind of theirs, and they would meet with that guy one-on-one, and they were able to have conversations and help guide and direct him. So there's still some sort of mentorship relationship there beyond the specific specialty that's happening. But that kind of goes away pretty quickly. Like, by the time we get to our day and you go and you walk into a modern college and the mentorship aspect is basically gone. Like, it's been abandoned. There's no mentoring. There's no apprenticeship style. It becomes more of an information and maybe skill, maybe skills transfer at the modern college. There's no real attempt. I mean, even my oldest son, who went to the college that was named earlier, and because this is recorded, right? So I got even there, right? Like there was no, they had tutors, and they would have all these great books discussions, and then there was no sense of like, okay, but now what do I do with all this information? Like what now? So what? Okay, now what? How does this? Like you've taught me, you've helped me explore this beautiful and amazing and incredibly good idea, and that in some sense is enough itself. Like it's enough itself to just understand the idea, but in another sense, like, but how does this affect us going into the future? How does this affect me and my relationship to the world, to reality, to God, to my friends, family, neighbors, right? There's this pendulum, right, where it's something is only valuable if it's applicable, or it's valuable in and of itself and application means nothing. And like, how do we find that middle space, right, of this is beautiful and good and lovely, and maybe I am supposed to just enjoy it. But then help me to see that's the reason, right? But in another sense, it's like, I've experienced something beautiful. Now, what does that mean when I walk through this life with my wife and my children and my friends and my family and you guys? That gets kind of left out. So even there, there's like mentoring, maybe, but it's really reduced, really limited. Unless the student goes out and seeks it, which is what my son did. Like he found the tutor that he trusted, that he loved, that he wanted to learn more from, and then he would invite that guy to lunch, to coffee, to, at a certain age, to beer, and have those conversations with him. And it was, so his experience there was lovely because he had that, but that's not necessarily normative. Today, I think most modern colleges are kind of falling into that trap, but I think there is kind of a recovery of it. There's still acknowledgement that I need somebody who knows Latin to teach me Latin. I need somebody that knows higher level math to teach me higher level math. I need somebody that knows higher level physics or whatever to teach me that stuff. And like, insofar as we're kind of marrying the two, I think that's good. I think that can be good. But we need that master discipleship relationship to be a part of it, to be personal, like we've been hearing, for it to be connected and meaningful and help us to see meaning in other things. There are some, I think, some programs that are trying to revive that, and I think this might be a little bit shameless and aggrandizing, but I think Gutenberg is that. Could I just rewind 25 years and or like 29 years and go here? I would want to see that and experience it for myself, but everything I hear, everything I read, everything I see, especially this weekend, is helping me to see like that's happening. Like Gutenberg might be the most world's best but hidden secret. Like we need help because it's happening. It seems to me that it's happening. Right, a student that goes through the 4 years at Gutenberg may have about 8 different tutors. But they have those 8 tutors the whole time and often together in the same discussions. Like the tutors are there together with them. And there's opportunity for relationship and there's opportunity for that communal, personal way of coming together, not just with their classmates, but also with the tutors and help for being guided through life. Insofar as it's intentional, then it's great. And then insofar as it just happens, also great. Like, it's there. The possibility for it is there, if not, you know, almost required. That's rare. That's not really happening anywhere else. I think we don't know that we need it, though, is part of the problem. We don't know that our kids need it. Our kids don't know that they need it. We don't know that we need it. And so something gets lost. There's still too much of, I'm going to college to get a degree so I can get a job, rather than I'm going to college to fulfill my humanity. And that humanity is personal and relational with peers, with mentors, and with the physical world and the spiritual world around us. The mentor has the capacity to do that because the mentor is a master of, like, how to know and how to learn, how to exercise wonder and inquiry to pursue the true, the good, the beautiful, all the classical education buzzwords, but they're real. The mentor may be a specialist, but that's not what makes him a mentor. What makes him a mentor or her a mentor is that relationship that he or she is having with the students and with the ideas. The typical classroom, traditionally, for me, in my experience, it feels like I'm going into a room and the teacher is there to transfer information to my head, to tell me what I'm supposed to believe. If he's good at it, which they can be, right? Teachers can be good at that and do it in a way that is less violent, intellectually violent, then they can feel like a sage. They can feel like a sage that you want to go to learn from. And that's like that, then it, at least it's comfortable. But if they're not, then it's just information dumping. And what we need and don't always realize is a guide to learning, how we can learn. Like, learning shouldn't be, you have to come here, sit in this chair, and listen to me pontificate. Learning should be you being able to go out into the world and discover. And then this is just something that supplements that, not the only way to learn, right? I'm not suggesting you guys leave right now. Wait till about 10:15. Because I told you, I have, my feelings get hurt easily. And yet, even though the master is not a sage or an information dumper, that doesn't mean the master doesn't or can't share his beliefs or his opinions. They can say what they believe, and they can talk about how things ought to be applied, but that's not the point of the relationship, right? The point of the relationship is this, is a guide to flourishing in our own humanity. Because when the teacher becomes an information dumper, it's kind of a horrible sounding word, an information transferer, there's actually a greater danger in that than the teacher who never tells you anything that you ought to know and just asks questions. Those teachers can be frustrating, but to some people, right? But that's way less dangerous than the one who's just constantly dumping, because the person who's constantly transferring information is more susceptible to propagandizing you, or just to students, right? Rather than propagating, That's an important distinction. And if you've not heard it before, I encourage you to read The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. And he has a pretty good couple pages in there kind of explaining this distinction. In the modern world, we think of propaganda as anything you're trying to put, anytime you're trying to push some idea onto another person. In Lewis's explication of it, propaganda is when you're pushing something false on another person. Propagation is when you are transferring the truth over to the next generation. The truth as we know it personally and in community, so through tradition and through science and through intuition and through, you know, all these different modes. And so in some sense, people will say, well, what is the difference between me propagandizing my false beliefs about X, or they wouldn't say it like that, but propagandizing this belief, which may be false, and you propagandizing Christianity, for example, which is, in my belief, true. To some extent, it is the truthfulness of it. But insofar as we're driven by fear that it won't be accepted, or insofar as we're driven by perhaps we don't believe it as strongly as we do or understand it as strongly as we do as being true, we can use propaganda-type tactics and then pass it on in a way that the students can't really believe it. The questions, though, the approach to it through the dialectic, through Socratic, through conversations, protects it from that, protects it from it becoming propaganda, even the truth, and can make it so that it's more believed, more readily received, so that it's not just this, as from the reading yesterday, from the discussions, for those of you who were there yesterday about the Menno, it can be received as more than just right opinion and maybe something closer to knowing, if that's a spectrum, I don't know. The information transferor has that risk, that danger involved with propagandizing even something that's true. So as a mentor, the mentor can do that, but it's always in the context of this relationship that's governing it and helping to guide it for the sake of the other. Yesterday I mentioned that the virtue in the ancient world of Eros, and Eros is one of the kinds of Greek love, right? There's Eros is like sexual, erotic, romantic, or physical love. And then you have phileo or whatever it is for friendship. Agape is self-sacrificing or whatever. I don't know all these words. And then that's the highest love. Like C.S. Lewis tells us in his book, The Four Loves, that's the highest love. In the ancient Greek world, and even in early Christianity, that's not true. That agape is not the highest love. The highest love is Eros. We put Eros as the lowest because it's so physical and sexual. But it's actually the highest love. And the reason they understand it that way is because they see it through these different levels. At the lowest level, Eros is physical because I'm driven by my physical self, my appetites, for food, sex, drink, comforts, pleasures, the people. But at the highest, so at the lowest level, Eros is the desire for union with this other person, but a physical, sexual union with the other person. At the highest level, Eros is the drive, the desire for union, but for spiritual union. I want spiritual union with you, which is exactly what Paul is calling us to in Corinthians, right? Or whatever epistle it is. We are called to be united to Christ in union, spiritual union with Christ and with his church, with the bride. That's Paul doesn't use the word eros there, but that's eros language in the ancient world and in the early church. So in some sense, there's the mentor has eros for the ideas or the wonder, the discovery, the inquiry of what he's pursuing. And then something maybe more like an agape or a phileo toward the student to want to bring about the good of that student. The student has an eros with the teacher, and that becomes an eros for the idea through the teacher. It's like a little kid falling in love with Samwise Gamgee because he just thinks Samwise. Do you guys know that book? It's this guy Tolkien. I don't know if you've heard of him. He wrote these fantasy books. But there's one where there's this character. His name is Sam, and kids love him. The kid loves Sam because Sam is lovable. But then what makes Sam lovable is how good a friend he is. But the kid doesn't fall in love with being a good friend. The kid falls in love with Sam. But then in being in love with Sam, or loving Sam, in loving Sam, I don't even know if that's allowed in Middle Earth. Can humans and hobbits? In loving Sam, they come to love, and through in loving Sam and imitating Sam, they come to love the thing that makes Sam Sam, which is his friendship, his commitment to friendship, his loyalty to his friend, and then they love that virtue, and they come to fulfill that virtue more and more and more. That's if by analogy, that's what's trying to happen in the mentor discipleship, the master discipleship relationship, is that the disciples love the master, but the master is embodying virtues and pursuing wisdom that they love the master, and they want a spiritual or an intellectual union with the master, not a sexual one, though it can be confused for that in the beginning. Because we're confused about love, in our day, it's a spiritual union with the master, an intellectual union with the master that then causes them to love the things the master loves, and then their desire for union becomes to be pointed aimed at that. I want union with justice. I want union with courage. I want union with truth, goodness, beauty, God, that's an important role in the ancient world and in the early church for eros. But I understand, right, that it's scary because eros is so perverted for us today. It's so distorted and reduced for what it is. We can't see it as a desire for union, but rather a desire for the S word. It rhymes with hex. What are the different kinds of teachers then in these different categories? I'm going to use three ways of talking about it that these are specific to this talk, like just to bring clarity to the ideas. I'm not sure the names are the right names, but I'm going to describe kind of the lowest level teacher as teacher. And then there's a middle level of teacher that I'm going to call the mentor. But I'm going to call him the chosen mentor. And then the highest level teacher, I'm going to call the mentor, but I'm going to call him the choosing mentor. So teacher, chosen mentor, choosing mentor. And the thing about the teacher is kind of what I've been getting at, right? His job is to transfer information and skills from himself to the students. And he's not necessarily concerned with the student doing anything other than receiving that. He wants you to be good at solving the Pythagorean theorem. He wants you to be good at knowing all the names of the presidents of the United States. He wants you to be good at reading Jane Eyre. That's his job. That's what he's here to do. And that's what he's going to do. And if you successfully complete that, good for you. I did my job. And if you didn't, I did my job and you're just bad at receiving, typically. That's not always true, right? Some teachers may be the simply teachers, as I'm defining it here, and yet still recognize they failed in some way. But it's a transactional relationship in some sense. And therefore, the student, the disciple, and the master in some sense remain unknown to each other. In complete violation to everything we've been hearing this weekend, right? And all the talks, there's this unknownness, this state of being unknown remains, and that's not knowledge. That's not getting us to knowledge or to the perception of the truth. The next level is the choosing mentor. And the chosen mentor, I hope you didn't write choosing, and now you have to cross it out and rewrite it as chosen. The chosen mentor is—it's kind of like what I do in the apprenticeship. In some sense, people send in applications, and I go through the applications and I say, "I want this one, and I want this one, and I want this one." In some sense, but it doesn't really happen that way, practically speaking, because I don't always know the people that I'm getting applications from. Like, the only thing I know about you is what you wrote in your handwritten essay. Did you know there's a handwritten essay requirement to apply? Do you know how many people don't apply because of that? Way more than you would think, which is kind of sad. But anyways, you have to write this handwritten essay. And the idea is that we're able to see something a little bit more unedited about you. But people know that we're doing that, so then they type it up, and then they read it, and edit it, and edit it, and then they copy it by hand. Okay, you guys are missing the point. Don't do that. I don't really get to choose. I mean, I do, but I don't really get to choose. Like, I'm chosen by the applicants. They say, I want to be in that group for any number of reasons. I want to be in that group because it's in North Carolina, and that's close to me. I want to be in that group because the meeting dates that it has are the most convenient for my schedule. I want to be in that group because the weekly call or the monthly calls are at a good time for me. I want to be in that group because he's a guy, or the alternative. I want to be in that group because she's a woman. Sometimes it's also, I want to be in that group because I've heard Matt speak and teach and I like his style and blah, blah, blah. The people who choose for that reason, they regret it when they get there, by the way. I make sure of it. I'm just kidding. But for the most part, they choose me. And that means I'm a chosen mentor in this sense. And that's not a bad thing. Like there's still a level of knownness here. Like, I come to know them very well. The disciples, the apprentices, and the apprentices come to know me well, which is a scary thing, because being known is scary, but also not being known is awful. So what do? Do you choose awful or scary? Right? That's probably why the house that I live in right now, I moved into in January 2021. When I moved into that house at the age of 44, I had moved into the 51st home in my life. I have moved more, on average, more than once a year. And I was only in the military for 10 years of that time. And in the military, it actually increased the average time. Like, I actually lived in the same house for longer periods of time in the military than I did before that. The being known is terrifying to me. Like, every 3 years, I'm like, honey, can I start looking for other jobs? Can we move? Do you like Oregon? Have you been to Oregon? It's so nice. I actually said that to her last night. I was like, it is so lovely here. maybe in our old age we can move here and I can teach at Gutenberg. And she was just like, oh my gosh, just stop. And I was like, you're a bully. Like, who hangs up like that now? Did I just age myself again? I called her and I was like, I hope she doesn't listen to this. She will make so much fun of me. She's lovely. The knownness part is actually scary. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if somebody told me, yeah, we get students that come visit Gutenberg and they don't come back or they don't end up signing up. And part of it is because it's too relational. Like, that wouldn't surprise me. Like, people are terrified of being known. And yet, the thing we almost need most in the world is to be known. Yeah. And loved in spite of it. Like, here's the thing. I need love, right? Like, you guys have probably picked up on that. I need attention. I need to be loved. Oh, my gosh, why am I being so vulnerable right now? Is my time up? I don't want to teach at Gutenberg anymore. I need love and attention. And when I get it, I feel good for like this long. And then afterwards, none of this is happening consciously. This is just happening in my soul, and I'm like starting to figure it all out at 48 years old. It always only lasts this long because somewhere deep down inside, I know that the thing that you just laughed, the me that you just appreciated or laughed at or loved, you appreciate and laugh at and love because you don't know the real me. And so the love or the accolades, any of that stuff, whatever it is, you can give it to me because you don't know the real me. If you knew the real me, you wouldn't be doing that. Okay, so that's the conclusion that I'm drawing subconsciously. You look like you love me, but you really don't because you don't know me. And if you did, you wouldn't. Okay, now take that and apply that to my relationship with God. God does know me. So what does that mean? What do I believe about him? I believe that he can't love me. I need to insert a joke here to like unheavy that. I need some levity. Thank you. Okay, all right, we can move on. And it was like this year in my life when I realized that I felt that way even about my wife. That I was hiding myself even from her. And she couldn't know me and didn't know me. And if she did, she'd be gone. And so I resolved to change that. And I started keeping her up till 3 a.m. to talk about my feelings, which is super hard. And all I needed was her to still love me. And like one night, she was actually out of town. I was talking to her on the phone. And one night after I got off as I was getting off the phone with her, I said, I don't know how this feels for you, but I am terrified. And I just need you to do one thing. Tomorrow morning, I know you're busy because she was doing training stuff. I was like, I know you're going to be busy, but just in the morning, just text me and say you still love me. Like, you're telling me you love me now, but if you sleep on it, that all could change, right? Just text me that you still love me. And she said, I will, I promise. And I said, now you realize if you don't do that, what I'm going to assume. And she's like, I know. And then she sends me this little gif, that says, I love you so much, you donut even know it. And there was like a dancing donut the next morning, and I was like, okay, that counts. She knew I needed the levity, right? She loved me through that. And as she continues to love me through that, through all of these like revealings, it becomes easier for me to believe that other people can love me and ultimately that God can love me. And it's there's like something healing for me that makes me realize even more so how important the mentor master disciple relationship is, because it demands it. It demands the knowing. That doesn't mean that every disciple will do it or every mentor will do it, but they have to for it to work. So the chosen mentor, that's possible. Like I can have those kinds of relationship with people, especially now that I'm learning to do it better. But in some sense, the chosen mentor relationship, it affects the words of Jesus, the disciple will become like his master. And that's good, in a good way. But it kind of ends there. And a really good example of this historically are the rabbis of the first century. That, I mean, at least as far as I understand it, the rabbis of the first century were, the heads of their schools, this rabbinical school, and then the Jewish men that wanted to learn from that rabbi would come to him. They would choose him. I want you to be my mentor, my teacher, my rabbi. They would come to him, and then they would sit at his feet, and then he would teach them, and he would mentor them, and they would become like him. And then when they were of age or when they were of stature or quality, they would go and continue that model, and they would become the heads of their own rabbinical schools, and then people would come to them. That's kind of what happens typically in even like the Circe apprenticeship, and probably in some sense even in Plato's Academy and Aristotle's Lyceum. But there's this next level of mentor that is so much more important, which is the choosing mentor. And this is the difference between Christ and the rabbis. Christ, Jesus, goes out into the world and says, "You follow me. You follow me." And he gathers these disciples to him. I don't think this has anything to do with what I'm talking about, but it is very interesting to me that the TV show The Chosen, has anybody seen that? In that show, Jesus calls everybody. They act it out, right? It's all put on display. He goes to Peter and Andrew. He goes to Matthew. The Matthew one, like, that's like, I just fall apart. I crumble on that one. I can cry easily. I can't be vulnerable easily. It's different for me. I'm a big baby when I watch that show. It's kind of dumb. I don't even know how accurate it is. I just think it just makes me cry. Except one. In the show, he does not call. You can guess who it is. And they actually don't have him call Judas. Judas comes to him and says, "Can I follow you?" And he says, "Come on." And he does. It's very interesting. I don't know how intentional that is or whatever. I don't know if that's biblical. I don't know. Kind of makes me want to go back and reread the Gospels. I don't remember. But they have it. They reverse that step. And whether it's biblical or scriptural or not, I'm not sure, but it kind of fits the distinction here, right? Like he can only take Judas so far, or that sounds weird. Anyways, I'm going to stop there because I want to avoid saying anything heretical. but right, there's something going on there where Judas doesn't fit the bill. So Jesus goes out and he calls people to him. The choosing mentor calls people to him. And then the same thing happens between the choosing mentor and the chosen mentor. Like all the same things that the chosen mentor does, the choosing mentor does. But the choosing mentor goes further. The choosing mentor is not just trying to make you the best version of what it is you want to be, the leader of a rabbinical school or a geometer or painter, sculptor, whatever, right? The chosen mentor is doing that. The chosen mentor is like, "You came to me to be the greatest sculptor you can be. that's, I'm going to do that. I'm going to teach you everything I know to make that possible. And that's it. Kind of ends there. But it does happen in a relational setting. When the choosing mentor does that, it doesn't stop there. I'm going to make you like me and more. I'm going to put you into a place where you not only know how to be successful, but where you can actualize that potential. You actually have, whatever. If you think about it in a modern career setting, right? Like, you have a job, let's say you're into coding, you have an IT job, you're tech, you're a coding guy. And you have some guy that's a mentor to you because he's really good at coding, he's better than you at coding, and he helps you become a better coder. That's a chosen mentor, in the way I'm categorizing it. A choosing mentor would do all of that and say, hey, there's this really good opportunity at this other job, this other company, you should apply for it because that will help you advance. Right, he's looking for those kinds of opportunities for you. In modern terms, I've heard this described as a difference between a mentor, they call the chosen mentor just mentor, and they call the choosing mentor a sponsor. And so they make a distinction between mentor and sponsor. But I didn't like the word sponsor, so I decided to use the same word for both and then add a modifier to it. Hope that wasn't confusing. But the choosing mentor cares about that beyond. Like, it's not just how can I give you everything I can do in a way that's relational, but also how can I help you to flourish? How can I set you free? Which is what parents do, right? Parents are these kinds of mentors. They're choosing, I choose you, kind of. But like, it's there, right? You're choosing to care for that child. And then take that child, give that child everything you can until you can set them free. That's how you set people free. Yeah. And then to help them flourish and hope and pray that they'll keep coming back to you with questions about how to do that, and you can offer that advice, and then trying not to offer the advice when they're not asking for it, because that causes problems, especially with, 18 and 19 and 20-year-olds. That's the distinction. So then I think about that and I realize, how do you get chosen? Like, what if you're on the disciple end and you want to be chosen by the mentor? You want the mentor to do the choosing. You want that kind of sponsorship. So then I was thinking about, okay, well, how do I do it? Do I do it? And how do I do it? And I think it does happen even in the Circe apprenticeship where I'm being chosen. There's a way in which I return that and choose back. And it's usually throughout the course of the program, but people stand out to me as like, this person has potential that I'm capable of supporting, helping with. This person has demonstrated a desire for it. This person has demonstrated a willingness to accept it. Like, they want it and they're willing to listen to me be guided, and there's that potential that it's possible. When I see that in a disciple, then I become, like, subconsciously, I become more willing to be this extra level, this mentor plus, for them, with them, and want to offer them those sorts of things. That's obviously different than the way Jesus, right, did it. Like, Jesus didn't call Peter because Peter met those three qualifications. He called Peter because he willed it, he wanted it, he chose it. I don't know, whatever. I'm a lesser mentor than Jesus is, of course, but But there is a way in which I can do that choosing, and I can help with that. I can support that and want to offer that to people. So it's kind of beautiful, like, when that happens, to be able to offer that. And there's always kind of a desire, like, in the back, right? Like, in the back of my mind that there's somebody there that I wish I could offer it to, and they don't want it. or there's a desire to want to offer that to just kind of everybody and just know that's not possible. Like, I'm also a limited human being, right? And I can't handle all 12 like Jesus did. I got to have my one and my three that I take off, the three that I take off to Mount Tabor, and those are the special ones. Everybody else is, no, I'm just kidding. just kidding. But anyways, let me just kind of wrap it up. The mentor is a mentor because of that relational component, that personal component with his disciples. And that relationship creates the ability to be known and therefore to know and to flourish through that, as scary, as terrifying it might be to many people. I suppose there are some people that isn't a problem for them, but clearly it was for me. And I suspect others. But then there's this kind of special relationship that becomes possible because of that, where that mentoring can turn into something even greater, sponsorship or whatever, right? Where there's a mutual choosing. You chose me, and I have the opportunity to choose you back. I couldn't choose you first because I didn't know you, but now that we know each other, I can choose you. And that mutual choosing can take it to the next level, and become a relationship, not where you're there in a transactional way to get something from me, and I'm not there in a transactional way to get something from you, but we're there because I want your good. And that's when Eros becomes the highest level love, when there's a spiritual union that is effected for the good of the other, right? God desires union with us for our good. We desire union with him for our good, but also for his glory. And that mutual union is ultimate in some way. And the ability to act that out and embody it with one another in this mentor disciple master discipleship, mentor apprenticeship relationship, helps us, heals us in a way to help us to do that with God. May the Lord remember you in his kingdom. Thank you.
That was Bless Master, the Master-Disciple Approach to Education by Matt Bianco. You've been listening to a recording provided by Gutenberg College. You can find more information about Gutenberg College on our website at www.gutenberg.edu. Any broadcast or retransmission of this recording without the express written permission of Gutenberg College and the conference speaker is prohibited. Thank you for listening.